This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens, and whatever is in the earth, is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him, but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's senior nuclear negotiator said that the country's uranium enrichment program will stop or slow down prior to the removal of all U.S. sanctions. Israel says it won't cooperate with the International Criminal Court's probe into its war crimes in the Palestinian territories. Also coming up, U.S. President Joe Biden calls for gun violence in his country an epidemic and an international embarrassment. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. There are signals that the United States may remove all the sanctions on Iran. That's what Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said. He reiterated that Iran will resume its suspended commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal only if all the U.S. sanctions are removed. Political commentator Wilmer Leon says the United States was the party that withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and should therefore be the first to resume its compliance with the agreement.
And that it was the United States that breached the OP5, that breached the agreement. The one who breached the agreement is the one that needs to come back into compliance in the agreement. So, and understanding how Iran's position is based on integrity, it is based on honesty, and there is a strong moral base to the Iranian position, then yes, I think Iran is heading down the right path. The United States is the one that withdrew from the agreement. The United States is the one that can't be trusted. So the United States is the one that needs to demonstrate not only to Iran, but demonstrate to the rest of the world that when the American government takes a position, that the American government stands behind the position that it takes.
Iran's military has pledged to respond to a recent attack on one of its vessels in the Red Sea. The Iranian Armed Forces spokesman, Brigadier General Abdul Fazl Shakarchi, said Tehran needs to ascertain the source of the incident first. He added that if the source of the attack on the ship is uncovered, Iran will definitely respond and won't be silent. Shekarchi stressed that Iran cannot take a decision on what it is going to do until the investigations are concluded with utmost accuracy. He, however, noted that Tehran is considering its traditional adversaries, the United States and Israel, as well as their regional allies, to be linked to the incident. The Iranian ship Saviz was attacked on Tuesday morning off the coast of Djibouti. The attack caused minor damage to the ship. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a successful and precise retaliatory drone strike against military targets in Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Saria said the attack targeted warplane hangars in an airport in the southwestern city of Jizan. However, Saudi Arabia claimed it had destroyed a Yemeni explosives-laden drone in the same city. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have been carrying out retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. They have vowed to continue the raids until Riyadh stops its aggression. Yemeni activist and political commentator Hossein Abukhaiti says Yemeni retaliatory attacks have diminished the Saudi ability to carry out aerial offenses against its southern neighbor.
Yes, to be honest with you, this type of attack that has been targeting for the last 2 years Jizan Airport and as well Abha Airport, including as well Najran Airport, those Saudi are actually a civilian airport, but they have been used by Saudi fighter jets because they are close to the Yemeni border to target Yemen and to target civilians in Yemen. That's why when Yemeni army have started targeting those airports, we have noticed that attack and Saudi strike has been reduced into Yemen because of those attacks mainly focus on Saudi fighter jet warplane hangars, as it happened today about an hour ago, as General Sari has announced. Until now, I think that the Yemeni army, they should actually extend their attack. They should target Saudi Arabia with more fighter jets. They should target their oil infrastructure, because till now Saudi has not allowed any fuel ship to enter Hodeidah. And by using a simple app like Vessel Finder or Marine Radar app in anybody's phone, you can notice that there are about 11 oil tankers just in the middle of the Red Sea in front of Jizan port. And there is only one oil tanker has reached Hodeidah, but still is still waiting in Hodeidah port for a permission from Saudi coalition to unload its fuel.
Israel says it won't cooperate with the International Criminal Court's investigation into the regime's possible war crimes in the Palestinian territories. In a statement, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said that the Hague-based court has no authority to open an investigation against Israel. The statement comes ahead of a Friday deadline to respond to an ICC notification letter on an impending investigation. The inquiry is expected to focus on issues such as Israel's wars on the Gaza Strip, its illegal settlement activity in the occupied West Bank, and its killing of Palestinian protesters in Gaza since 2018. Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute, which established the ICC. The Palestinians, who have been a state party since 2015, have welcomed the investigation. Elsewhere, violent clashes erupt between police and pro-British unionist protesters after a night of rioting in the capital of Northern Ireland, Belfast. A crowd of young people hurled petrol bombs and stones at police, who in turn fired water cannons to disperse the angry protesters. British and Irish governments, as well as local political leaders, have condemned the riots. So far, dozens of people, mostly police officers, have been injured in protests that started on Sunday. The demonstrators are opposed to post-Brexit trade barriers between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. The restrictions are to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Ireland. Critics say the barriers will strain the region's ties with the rest of the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, new polls suggest that support for Welsh independence from the UK is at an all-time high. This has created fear in Downing Street over the real threat of a kingdom break-up with the Welsh Parliament elections on the way. Robert Carter brings us the latest.
The idea of a Welsh breakaway from the United Kingdom is high on the agenda ahead of this year's Welsh elections, with the country's biggest pro-independence party, Plaid Cymru, pledging to secure a vote on Welsh independence within the next 5 years.
The first time in a Senate election, the people of Wales will be able to vote to take their future into their own hands. We believe independence to be the only sure and sustainable means for achieving social and economic progress and for tackling the climate emergency.
The idea of Wales going alone has traditionally been an obscure viewpoint. However, since Brexit, public support for an independence vote has skyrocketed. One poll conducted this year actually suggested that Welsh support for independence could be as high as 39%. That would be the highest level ever recorded.
Wales, like Scotland, is a historically constituted nation whose existence as an independent nation predates its membership of the UK by centuries. London will do its best to make it very difficult for both Scotland and Wales to come out seamlessly.
Number 10 has reportedly become very aware of the growing anti-Westminster sentiment outside of England and are drawing up plans to counter the trend.
This is a state forged in mercantilism, prolonged experiment in semi-feudalism at home and colonialism overseas. And it's high time it was brought to... The contradictions cannot be surmounted anymore. Brexit was the last brick in the wall in this regard.
The Welsh elections are taking place in May. Plaid Cymru have been recording great successes in past votes and hopes are high of more major gains.
Although support for independence has not yet reached a majority view, Westminster's poor handling of the coronavirus pandemic, combined with the negative effects Brexit has had on the Welsh economy, appear to have fueled greater support in the virtues of self-government. And with Scotland also pushing hard for a UK divorce right now, fears at number 10 of a breakup of the UK appear to be growing just as rapidly as Welsh patriotism is. Robert Carter, London.
US President Joe Biden has issued a series of executive orders aimed at tackling gun violence in his country.
But today we're taking steps to confront not just the gun crisis, but what is actually a public health crisis. Gun violence in this country is an epidemic. Let me say it again. Gun violence in this country is an epidemic, and it's an international embarrassment. There's much more that Congress can do to help that effort, and they can do it right now. They've offered plenty of thoughts and prayers, members of Congress, but they've passed not a single new federal law to reduce gun violence. Enough prayers. Time for some action.
Biden's measures mainly target homemade firearms. They include efforts to increase background checks for gun buyers. The measures, however, have been criticized by Republicans. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy called them an unconstitutional overreach. He said his party would pursue every option to protect the Constitution's Second Amendment that gives people the right to keep and bear arms. Figures show more than 40,000 people annually lose their lives to gun violence in the United States. A respiratory doctor has testified on the ninth day of the trial over George Floyd's death, saying the African-American died from a lack of oxygen. Martin Tobin told a court session that Floyd's breathing was weakened and that caused his heart to stop. He dismissed defense claims that pre-existing medical conditions may have contributed to Floyd's death. Tobin added that even after Floyd stopped breathing, white former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin continued to pin him down on the streets. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges. His defense team has argued that he did only what he was trained to do in his 19 years as a police officer. 46-year-old Floyd's death sparked massive protests against police brutality and racial injustice in the U.S. Political commentator John Parker says many cases like the Floyd's happen across the country, but officers can get away with their actions most of the time, as there is no video evidence.
The thing is that the George Floyd case, if there was no video of George Floyd, this wouldn't even be being talked about. There would be the cop, Chauvin, wouldn't even be on trial, which means to say that this happens over and over and over again, systemically over and over again, and only because it was exposed by video was the fact that this case came up. But they could have tried many other cases, and both the Democratic and Republican parties are not serious about the safety of black and brown people in this country. The only thing Biden said was maybe you should shoot them in the leg. They're not serious, and there's a reason for that. I mean, the U.S. economy is on an advanced stage of decay, and more dollars are invested in financial speculation than in production, which means the ruling class, the corporations, are very desperate to make a profit. And the only way they can make a profit is by taking more and more money from especially black and brown communities, working class communities, taking away the services and things. And when you do that, people want to fight back. They want to protest. They want to demand economic justice. And in order to stop them from doing that, you allow the police to keep them in fear. And that's what this is. It's a purposeful thing, these murders that are going on, like George Floyd, to keep us in fear so we won't fight back.
Turning to some coronavirus news now, the total confirmed cases in the United States are nearing 31 million. That's according to data by the country's Johns Hopkins University. The data also showed that more than 560,000 Americans have lost their lives to the virus. The U.S. has the largest case count and death toll in the world. The country's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say more than 20,000 infections are related to the new variants of the coronavirus. It says the majority of those infections have been caused by the British strain. The U.S. began its COVID vaccination program in mid-December 2020. President Joe Biden has said all American adults will be eligible for the vaccine by April the 19th. Breaking news reaching us here on Iran has confirmed a previous statement by South Korea's foreign ministry that one of its vessels that had been crossing the Persian Gulf, which had been seized by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Force for violating maritime rules, has been released. We did hear an earlier statement from South Korea, and Iran has now confirmed the news that vessel has been released along with its captain, detained over environmental pollution and violations of maritime laws. Moving ahead, Turkey plans to impose stricter measures to bring COVID-19 under control, with some even suggesting a full lockdown throughout the holy month of Ramadan. This comes as the number of daily cases has surged to almost 55,000, the highest daily count in the country since the start of the pandemic last year. Tuğçe Sagram is in Istanbul.
Turkey has reported an unprecedented surge of daily coronavirus cases. The new infections stood at almost 55,000 on Wednesday, as the highest in the country since the outbreak of the pandemic last year. Turkish government plans to reduce the numbers during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan to welcome tourists again after the month. Turkish president said that he wants to see a significant reduction in the number of coronavirus infections by the end of Ramadan. As he announced last week that during the holy month, restaurants restaurants and coffee shops' work will be limited to takeout and delivery services only. Meanwhile, Turkey will continue to witness a daily curfew from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. and total weekend lockdowns.
We aim to give a rest to our country during Ramadan and prepare it for better days after the Eid. If we could decrease the number of the cases to thousands, we will be able to catch the tourism season that is understood to be opened in May and the commercial activity that will be created by the tourism season.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca said earlier that 75% of the new coronavirus cases in the country are from the more contagious variant detected in Britain. This as the country is still open for tourists who are not included in the curfew and lockdown measures. Some analysts believe the latest measures is the reason behind the sudden increase in the new cases.
We expected to see a spread of the virus amid the third wave. However, we didn't expect to see such high numbers, especially after we began public vaccination. Turkish government's trying to create a balance between people's health and economy. That's why it's trying to implement measures to contain the spread of the virus until at least 60% of the country is vaccinated.
Turkey is pressing ahead with its nationwide vaccination campaign using the Sinovac and Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine shots. So far, more than 10.55 million people have been given the first doses and 7.41 million were given the second. Turkey's announcement of a nationwide lockdown during the holy month of Ramadan has created chaos, which is seen by many as the reason behind the increasing number of daily infections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, Make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
National Day of Nuclear Technology. On 9th of April 2007, the Islamic Republic of Iran launched a second complex of centrifuges at Natanz nuclear facility, under the full supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, the United Nations nuclear watchdog. Thus, Iran entered the phase of industrial enrichment of uranium. To appreciate the tireless efforts of young Iranian scientists, that day, 9th of April, was named as National Day of Nuclear Technology in the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have prepared a special feature on this occasion. Stay with us. Peaceful nuclear technology is one of the most important branches of modern science and technology, as it plays a significant role in securing energy, especially in developed and developing countries. The civilian nuclear industry in Iran has benefited from domestic capabilities and has been concentrated on four axes: completion of the nuclear fuel cycle, access to advanced technologies, production of energy, and application of radioisotopes in agriculture, industry, and medicines. Among Iran's achievements in the nuclear know-how, gaining access to the full enrichment cycle is of high importance, as it provides the fuel needed to power plants and research reactors. Designing of nuclear fuel needs very sophisticated technology. Thank God, the Islamic Republic of Iran has proved its scientific capabilities by gaining access to 20% enriched nuclear fuel in the shortest possible time. Currently, the Tehran Research Reactor uses sheet fuel that is produced at Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. Another important domain for the application of nuclear know-how and technology is medicine. Different services such as radiotherapy and treatment with radioisotopes are some of the uses of nuclear technology in medicine. Nuclear energy has a wide range of use in medicine. Despite the illegal sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran, the Iranian nuclear researchers have succeeded to develop power plants and put this valuable energy at the service of medicine, agriculture, and removal of microorganisms. Iran has succeeded in producing radioisotopes and radiomedicines that are used for diagnosis and treatment of certain kinds of cancer. Many different types of radioisotopes for use in medicine are produced within the Islamic Republic of Iran. For instance, production of radio medicines with the help of cyclotron radiation has been one of the great nuclear achievements in Iran in the past years. Iran has taken big strides in manufacturing nuclear medicines. The Amirabad Research Reactor, which uses to produce limited numbers of radio medicines and radioisotope for domestic consumption, has increased its activity. Nuclear energy is one of the clean energies in the world. Currently, over 430 nuclear power plants are active across the world. In many countries like France, they secure their electricity mainly through nuclear power. The nuclear output and consumption in the United States, too, has surged to 40% during the period 1920 to 1970. Although the country enjoys huge fossil fuel reserves. This means that the need for nuclear energy has doubled in nearly every 10 years. The energy gained through nuclear fission can be used to produce electricity. The Islamic Republic of Iran, too, has been seriously pursuing the construction of nuclear power plants to meet increasing demand for electricity. In view of this, 9th of April is the day in which Iran entered the Club of Nations, which have access to the full nuclear fuel cycle. This peaceful breakthrough is a major step towards development and progress. Iran is ready to share its expertise and experiences in the peaceful civilian nuclear field with other countries in the region and beyond. Peaceful nuclear technology is currently being used to identify underground water basins and water reserves, direction of surface and underground water flows, discovery and control of leakage and safety of dams, and desalination of water. As for the use of peaceful nuclear technology in agriculture and the food industry, this technology is capable of being used in shooting of crops, control and elimination of insects in agriculture, delay food deterioration, and increase crop harvests. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization has concluded more than 300 research, implementation, and operation contracts with over 60 academic and scientific centers in the country. This year, on the National Day of Nuclear Energy, 9th of April, more than 50 achievements related to nuclear technology will be unveiled. In view of this, the expansion of peaceful nuclear industry and unveiling of more achievements symbolize Iran's might and national pride. The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken all nuclear steps in full compliance with international nuclear conventions and accords, whereas those countries which have made every effort to hinder Iran's peaceful nuclear program have stockpiles of nuclear weapons and are immune from any supervision and monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA. Iranian officials have always said that nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction have no place in Iran's purely defensive doctrine. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has prohibited the use of all weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons, in his fatwa or religious edict. The leader said in 2019, if knowledge is separated from correct culture, it will err. The useful nuclear knowledge, due to not accompanying the philanthropic culture, resulted in the nuclear bomb, and today remains as a threat to the world. Although we could, we didn't enter this path decisively and bravely. Both making and keeping atomic weapons is wrong, because its usage is haram or religiously forbidden.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Years into the brutal Saudi war on Yemen, the Yemeni armed forces refused what they called the deceitful ceasefire offer of Al Saud. 6 full years of massacres and bombardment campaigns, sanctions and blockade, and Al Saud blatantly won the Yemeni Salvation Government to give up arms and negotiate. However, the Yemeni resistance Ansarullah have refused to put down their weapons and enter any Saudi proposed talks before the full cessation of the Saudi war and the lift of all forms of blockade against the Yemeni nation. The Saudi plan supposedly includes a UN-supervised ceasefire, measures to reopen Sana'a airport in the Yemeni capital, and the lifting of trade restrictions on the Ansarullah-controlled Hudaydah port, but with a twist. The Saudis want to control the airport and the seaport themselves, while also sharing revenues on trade in oil through Hudaydah. Mohammed bin Salman wants to snatch through politics what he was not able to achieve through 6 years of extensive warfare against Yemen. For the Yemeni resistance, the devil is in the details. The Saudi aim is clear. Control of vital Yemeni port of entries after they successfully suffocated the nation, leading it to become the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Whereas the Yemeni resistance wants Hudaydah port and Sana'a airport to be completely open to all international traffic, as they should. The Saudi overture appears to double down on the idea that it is the Yemeni resistance who is being asked to make concessions here, at a time when not only most Saudi-occupied cities have been liberated, but also scores of bomber drones on a weekly basis keep revisiting Saudi oil facilities and military bases in the heart of the kingdom. Ansarullah's response was very clear. This is an old offer, they said. Any new offer should begin with completely lifting barriers to movement on Hudaydah port and Sana'a airport. Using the humanitarian crisis as leverage is simply seen as a deceitful Saudi attempt, and Yemen will not fall for it. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. After 6 years of brutal Saudi war on Yemen, the Saudi ceasefire offer was taken by Yemen as nothing short of a joke. What is proposed to the Yemenis is not an end to the war. It is just a ceasefire while all other forms of war continue, such as blocking the airport, seaport, and the borders. What is proposed to Yemenis is a major deceit that neither Ansarullah or the Yemeni children would even accept to fall for. To discuss this issue with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you a lot for being with us, Patrick. Now, Yemeni officials in Sana'a have recently emphasized that Yemen is only open to what they called a fair and honorable peace. That has nothing to do with the deceitful act of the ceasefire offered by Al Saud there, but while maintaining the blockade and maintaining the bombardment campaign against civilian areas in Yemen. Why is the world acting like Yemen has any other option than to actually wait for the war to stop and the blockade to be lifted?
I don't think Saudi Arabia or the world, or the Western world for that matter, I don't think they're in a sort of space of reality, because these are all negotiation tactics that we have seen in the past. So, and the West, Saudi Arabia, these powers, they believe that they have leverage on the basis that they have military superiority and they have regional hegemony and they have control of the major waterways, ports, et cetera, the sky, the air, et cetera. So this is why they're negotiating as if the Yemeni Ansarullah's capitulation is a fait accompli. But that's not actually how it works when you're in a conflict. And right now, Saudi Arabia is still the aggressor. They can't change that fact. They're in a foreign country, so they don't have the leverage. And so they want to continue to strangle the Yemenis, to strangle Ansarullah in order to somehow get some concessions or some leverage on negotiation. And the Yemenis aren't going to agree to a ceasefire without getting exactly what they want, especially after everything that's happened.
This is why we should maybe look into this initiative. The Saudi initiative is said to include a nationwide ceasefire under the control or the supervision of the UN, supposedly. The reopening of Sana'a Airport and Hudaydah Port. But knowing that the power in those areas, Hudaydah Port, the airport, are in the hands of Ansarullah, could this actually be some sort of a new maneuver for Mohammed bin Salman to try and take control over them, since he already failed to do so militarily?
Possibly, but it could also be a sort of a long-term or medium to long-term strategy, because we've seen this in Syria. We've learned over the last few years that when an international ceasefire is declared, one party will use this as an opportunity to retrench or to sort of double down or to gain some ground that they had previously lost. Certainly this is something strategically that Saudi Arabia and its backers would like to do. And so for the Yemenis, they're totally in a defensive position, so there's no really change in their strategy. But so the West, who's backing Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis and their allies are looking for some changes in order to change the strategic landscape. So we've also seen this in Libya. You have half the country, or Tripoli, under a UN administration, as it were. In Yugoslavia, we saw similar tactics with third parties coming in like the UN, and that can create other situations that's going to disrupt or allow one party not to be able to realize the gains that it would like on the battlefield, as it were.
But Patrick, with 5 million people in the country and currently teetering on the edge of starvation, and we have over two-thirds of the country's population in need for both food, medicine, and protection. Do you think that Yemen still has more time to waste for such a stalemate offer by Saudi Arabia? And what is the role of the international community in this one?
In terms of the famine, in terms of the human devastation, the humanitarian devastation, there's not a lot that can be done outside of Saudi Arabia withdrawing, its allies withdrawing, and basically leaving Yemen to govern itself, which was the previous status quo. Outside of that, it's going to be difficult. The end game has always been, for Saudi Arabia and its allies, has been partition or regime change, or both. And I really truly believe that they thought this was going to be over within 18 months of when it began in March of 2015, and that hasn't been the case. So if the Yemenis are still where they were before, they're still fighting to preserve their sovereignty, and that's not really going to change despite the devastation.
Well, the Rights and Legal Department at the Yemeni Ansarullah Political Bureau issued its first human rights document that was issued about a week ago about brutal crimes committed by the Saudi-U.S. aggression against Yemeni civilians. We have, it was, by the way, entitled Yemen's Hiroshima. The report included 4,133 documented massacres and bombing incidents in residential areas with details regarding the time and the place of their occurrences. Saudi Arabia has been stacking war crimes in Yemen for the past 6 years. Will Mohammed bin Salman and maybe his
generals ever be brought to justice over these horrendous crimes? Do we have a chance against these people?
I think it's doubtful, and this is because international law is at an all-time low, and it's really receding year by year. They are the only person that are going to get justice from the international law system or end up in The Hague will be some African dictator that was probably installed by a Western power to begin with. Those are the only people you ever see showing up in The Hague, more or less. But so the bottom line is that what Saudi Arabia has done is guaranteeing bad blood between the neighbors on the Arabian Peninsula. And so you can't erase that. This is going to sow the seeds for potentially future conflicts. There needs to be a unilateral withdrawal on the side of Saudi Arabia and a cessation of hostilities. This is the only way that we're going to avert more humanitarian disaster. Everything besides that is just really going to be a protracted, painful conflict, unfortunately. And well, we'll see if the West is going to come in like a knight on a white horse to try to, you know, broker some sort of negotiations, but or some roadmap to peace. But at the end, I think it's too late for that.
Well, it seems that Biden is a bit in hot water whether to back Mohammed bin Salman or not. Sometimes he gives him a good word, sometimes three bad words in a row. But at the same time, Yemeni civilians are losing their lives. They're losing their lives from bombs falling on their heads, Western-made bombs. They're losing their lives from the famine created by Saudi Arabia with the help of the West. And at the same time, if the West thinks really that they're going to try and do anything to stop this without the consent of the Yemeni people, those same Yemenis that are still in control of swaths of land of their country that have been able to liberate the occupied parts of their country, then they are really in on a wrong side here. They don't really understand Yemenis yet. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will be next talking about the Lebanese crisis of economy. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
For the past 19 months, Lebanon has been reeling from a wrenching economic crisis. By the time the crisis erupted in October in 2019, the economy was facing four extraordinary challenges: elevated public sector debt, a bankrupt banking sector, no economic growth, and the country was politically rudderless. Predicting how the crisis evolves from here is difficult. Lebanon's economic crisis, a tragedy in the making, in this following report. Lebanon's annual inflation rate reached a record high, and food prices soared by around 500% in February, highlighting the dramatic impact on consumers and businesses of the country's worst financial crisis in decades. With hindsight, Lebanon's economic crisis was predictable. By the time the crisis erupted in October 2019, the economy was already facing four extraordinary challenges. First, public sector debt had reached such elevated levels that a default had become a question of when, not if. Second, the banking sector, having lent three-quarters of deposits to the government, had become functionally bankrupt and increasingly illiquid. Third, the productive economy had experienced virtually no growth for an entire decade, a development with acute socio-political implications. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the country was politically aimless. There was no president between 2014 and 2016. There were multiple and lengthy delays in cabinet formation, and the 2018 parliamentary elections took place, but only after a five-year delay. The Hariri government that was in place when the crisis hit in 2019 became impotent to such an extent that it lacked power to deliver on any of the reforms required as a condition for foreign support. By October 2019, the citizenry had had enough. Sensing a looming crisis and frustrated by the utter lack of action by the political class, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets demanding radical political change. The cabinet resigned, throwing the country into a political crisis. Unsurprisingly, capital inflows came to a sudden halt. Banks, already insolvent, experienced a sharp liquidity crunch, forcing them to declare a bank holiday and institute severe restrictions on bank withdrawals. A foreign exchange black market emerged, and the national currency, the lira, sharply depreciated. In return, inflation soared and people's real wages and purchasing power collapsed. In addition, as if all these woes aren't enough, a severe COVID-19 crisis hit the country, and most tragically, a devastating explosion took place on August 4, 2020, leveling a third of downtown Beirut. Human capital is fast eroding due to a massive brain drain of the young and skilled. Equally worrying is the loss of physical productive capacity resulting from widespread business closures. Much more alarming are the security consequences of the economic implosion. Lebanon's sectarian history is rife with conflict, and economic collapse provides a perfect habitat for a return of violence. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Nasri Harb, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Yuzal University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nasri Harb. Now, left to its own devices, the Lebanese economy will for sure generate an alarming acceleration of youth and skilled labor immigration. We have a lot of enterprises closing. The currency is becoming further unanchored. Hyperinflation is wiping the incomes of the public and their wealth. And we have now food and medical shortages that seem will only escalate, which requires more level of humanitarian support, foreign humanitarian support. That is the worst case scenario, and I thought that we were already there. Could this become even worse now?
Okay. Hi, Marwa. I think there is no limit to how bad we can go. Let me tell you this. As long as the government does not take any action, things will worsen. The hyperinflation will fuel itself. As a number, we can cite two recent examples from two economies. In Venezuela, for instance, where inflation has reached about 65,000%.
Wow.
That is a 71% inflation every month, which means that your salary that you receive at the beginning of the month will lose 70% of its value at the end of the month. So you are left with only 30%. Another typical example is, a famous example is Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, in the peak of the hyperinflation, currency used to lose a 98%, which is almost its whole value every day at the peak of the inflation. So there is no limit to how bad we can go.
That is a scary thought right there.
Indeed.
But there is one best case scenario for Lebanon that's being discussed all around now, is by starting with a cabinet. That should be giving some sort of a short-term stabilization program for the country, which involves tightening of liquidity, maybe arresting the fiscal implosion, maybe inducing capital control, especially on large amounts of money which are still being leaked out of the country, and maybe obtaining an urgent external bridge loan like that of the IMF. However, look, I understand all these points that are that we are speaking about, but wouldn't even more loans by the Lebanese be a burden for them rather than an actual escape from this reality?
The loan from the IMF, you can say it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, from one side, it will call for more reform. It will help. And it will ask for discipline from the government. However, on the other hand, if there is no discipline, if the loan is not well negotiated, because the trend at the IMF is to follow more liberal action, reducing government size, and taking harsh action towards the harsh harsh, let me say, harsh social action. So if it's not well negotiated, it may lead to further social problems.
You mean more privatization instead of actually maybe putting help towards the public institutions?
Exactly. So it takes like strong political action and a strong political negotiation to negotiate a good terms for these loans. That's one. Two, if this loan is not well used, it will add to the burden of the country, like the debt to the country, like similar to what happened to Paris conferences. We have received aids and billions of dollars, and after all, it came out like as a burden on the country.
And our debt becomes $120 billion.
Exactly.
But the annual inflation rate, Dr. Harbi, is that it reached a high record and the food prices soared. They are more than 500% this February 2021, highlighting the dramatic impact on both consumers and enterprises as well, especially because this is the worst economic crisis for at least two decades. How much longer do you think these businesses can withstand such a dramatic impact on them?
It's difficult to say, but however, the conditions are very harsh. If we can cite what are the problems faced by the businesses, it's unbelievable. You have one, reduced demand. People are poorer than before. Difficult investment because there is no exchange. Unstable exchange rate. You can start with a given price, and then at the end of the day, the price will be changed. Uncertainty, okay? You can never tell what to expect in the next day. Unmotivated employees, which will reduce the cost of production. Mm-hmm. You have also angry consumer, which will be very difficult to deal with. You have difficult financial transaction. If you want to export, if you want to import, how can I afford the exchange rate, okay? The cost of changing price is by itself. Cost of changing price is huge. Mm-hmm. In some cases, in some supermarket, like during, I think, German hyperinflation, 50% of the employees' time was on only changing prices.
So it's very costly for the enterprise.
So just changing prices takes like 50% of your resources. So
and the remaining 50% is now becoming a referee trying to stop people from killing one another.
That's
but
true.
What are you saying represents a public call, Dr. Nasri, to all Lebanese decision makers, whether it is the prime minister, designated one, the central bank governor, even the president of the republic as well? I personally do not see a glimmer of hope here. I'm a realist. But as an economist, what would be the first thing that you would do to try and salvage what is left of the economy in this country?
Okay. Well, we were speaking about that in a conference a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
What it takes at the beginning, first of all, like a political will. Okay. Once we have a political will, any action can help. It takes a multilateral plan. You have, first of all, of course, you have to have a sort of capital control. You have to and that's very important, to establish trust. So I would say trust, then trust, then trust. That's the first point. Capital control, restoration of banking sector, okay? And we can speak also about halting the money printing process, because this is the main cause of the inflation. Economical reforms and structural reforms. I can speak here about political reform and economical reform. Especially, like we can give an example, a simple example, which will be a good start, is to rebuild the electrical system for electrical sector. Rebuild it, okay. And an important one is to encourage import substituting industries,
mm-hmm.
because this is one of the main source of fleeing the currency.
See, this is what we lack in Lebanon, Dr. Nasri. We
mm-hmm.
should have someone like you to be Minister of Economy, and yet we are still fighting between one another which sect will get which ministry, which, by the way, puts me at a very depressed position as a Lebanese citizen, because I don't know whether tomorrow will be better
sure.
or even 10 times worse.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nasri Harab, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Izal University. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
in the limelight.
Astronomers recently found a tantalizing hint that life could be wafting through the clouds shrouding Venus. But it seems the hunt for extraterrestrial life is far from over, as new research is already calling that discovery into question. Stay with us for an article penned by Nadia Drake, a contributing writer at National Geographic, under the heading, "Promising Sign of Life on Venus Might Not Exist After All." The detection of phosphine gas in Venus's atmosphere announced last month ignited a firestorm of speculation about whether the gas could be produced by alien microbes on the planet, where NASA is currently considering sending a spacecraft. However, three independent studies now have failed to find evidence of phosphine in the Venusian atmosphere. One of the groups used archival observations to search for signs of the gas in the planet's clouds and didn't find it. Connor Nixon, a planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, says, "They're saying they don't see the phosphine. That's really problematic. The study has been peer-reviewed and accepted."